Now, the original founder of the Me Too movement popped up the other day to reflect on it. She says it has lost its way. Tarana Burke began using Me Too as a way of building community, solidarity with victims, and momentum for justice as she worked with women who'd been sexually abused in the US. A year ago this month, it all blew into a global movement after the revelations about the sexual predator and Hollywood heavyweight Harvey Weinstein. It has had its impact here in Australia, of course, with high-profile allegations against Don Burke, Craig McLaughlin, and Jeffrey Rush, among others. But Tarana Burke, a sexual assault survivor herself, says as a social media phenomenon, it has become too focused on perpetrators instead of victims. She says it is sending a false signal. She says we have to shift the narrative that it is a gender war, that it is anti-male, that it is men against women, and that it's only for a certain type of person, that it's for white, heterosexual, famous women. That, she says, has to shift. So has the Me Too movement lost its way? Michael Salter is an associate professor of criminology at Western Sydney University. He's been looking at the Me Too movement in the context of criminality and social media. And Diane White is a consultant working in the areas of gender equality and violence against women. She's a former principal advisor to the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission's independent review into sex discrimination and sexual harassment in the Victoria Police. Michael, Diane, welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Hello, Diane. If I can start with you, you've heard these comments from Tarana Burke. Has the Me Too movement, in your view, gone too far?
Yeah. Hi. Thanks, Hugh. I like Tarana's comments. I think that she's got a good point that in our coverage of Me Too, we do disproportionately focus on perpetrators, and we have lost sight, I think, of the experiences of victims and survivors, and the importance of finding ways to support them to heal and to recover. So I think that the point is well made. I think that the Me Too movement still has tremendous power. I think it's sort of still nascent, it's still growing, it's still evolving. It should continue to evolve and evolve in ways where it gains more nuance. And in particular, I think thinking about the different experiences and different groups that are impacted by sexual harassment, and indeed the different forms of marginalisation that impact on people's ability to come forward. So I think we've got room to improve in terms of it being a movement and a social movement, but I'm hopeful that we can continue to see some positive change from the movement.
What do you make about her criticism that it's effectively become essentially a white celebrity movement?
Yeah, I think that the movement itself it doesn't reflect that in all ways. I think that the media coverage of it tends to focus on those high profile cases and allegations, but on a very everyday level, what Me Too did was ignite thousands, millions of women to speak about their own personal experiences of sexual harassment. And those women were from all ranges of backgrounds and all walks of life. And I think that increasingly in the kind of conversations that women are having with each other, it's not about high-profile celebrities. It's not necessarily about the names that are splashed over the front of newspapers. It's actually about things that have happened to them, and they are finding that solidarity and finding that connection with other people who have had similar experiences, just as Tarana, did with her healing circles for many, many years prior to the campaign really getting the momentum it has.
Michael Salter, as a criminologist, what are your concerns with the Me Too movement?
I think Diane's point's really well made, which is that, Me Too has emphasised these common themes and threads through women's experiences of sexual harassment. I think celebrity culture's been a strength and a weakness of Me Too, in the sense that it has highlighted that, even women in quite privileged positions are still experiencing sexual harassment and exploitation. On the other hand, in terms of the way that particularly mass media has run with Me Too, it has tended to focus on the really salacious allegations against high-profile perpetrators. And the perpetrator focus justice at a certain point becomes quite overwhelming. And I think the underlying systemic reasons why sexual harassment happens, and then the real concrete obstacles for adjudicating these allegations and for delivering, you know, substantive justice, you know, those remain. And we do need a strategic approach to those obstacles. Simply speaking out on social media is not going to remove those obstacles. We have to take collective action to do that.
So, I mean, it is ultimately all about justice. And we do talk about women. We have to acknowledge that the Kevin Spacey case, for example, was not about women. So there are victims in this process other than women. But we'll for simplicity's sake, talk about it as a women's issue fundamentally, or an issue for everyone dealing with women. But it came from, would you agree, a failure of the law, a failure of the justice system, because the structures that were in place simply weren't working. What has the justice system, the criminal system, and the other legal protections, has there any sign of it making adjustments as a consequence of the Me Too movement to work better to protect women?
What we've seen over the last 6 years is that sexual assault complaints have increased year on year to police. We have a generation of young women in particular who are stepping forward to talk more readily about what's happening to them in terms of sexual assault and harassment. But once they encounter formal complaint processes in the criminal or the civil system, no, not enough change has been made. You know, in terms of sexual assault, for example, we haven't seen increased rates of prosecution for 10 years. It's under 50%. Appeal rates are still really high. And it's not a surprise that women are looking for extrajudicial ways of disclosing these experiences because formal complaint mechanisms aren't working for them.
So, I mean, Donald Trump said in the relation to the Brett Kavanaugh nomination to the Supreme Court, essentially that essentially arguing that there is no presumption of innocence left in the system. Dionne White, is that a necessary result of trying to get justice, that presumption of innocence has been a system that men have used to protect themselves, and that cornerstone of our legal system has to go?
I think it's more systemic than men necessarily using presumption of innocence to protect themselves. I think what we have is a system, and obviously most of these cases are dealt with in a civil context rather than criminal context, but a system that is not fit for dealing with the kinds of harm that stem from gendered violence. So we have systems that are adversarial, that are premised on the assumption that the victim or complainant is not telling the truth, you know, that they have to prove their case. So, you know, that the system itself is not geared well to deal with these kinds of issues. And I think Michael's, you know, absolutely hit the nail on the head when he talks about the fact that our systems and structures, despite, you know, movements in many other ways in terms of gender equality and understanding violence against women have struggled to shift, and part of that is because I think we still continue to use a system that ties up perpetrator accountability and victims' you know, need for redress in the same process, and those two things I think fundamentally are often incompatible. And increasingly, what I think we're starting to see, at least in a workplace context, is a recognition of this, and instead looking more towards redress schemes, for example, which can be a way of providing that kind of validation and that sense of justice to a person who's experienced harm without necessarily being focused on perpetrator accountability, at least perpetrator accountability at an individual level, rather focusing on organisational accountability. And I think this is a really positive move forward when we're looking at ways in which our institutions are starting to better respond to sexual harassment and other forms of gendered violence.
So if we're at the moment in a place where the law as it currently existed and the way in which it worked has not worked well enough, on the other hand, you've got what some people see as a digital mob with the Me Too movement. Somewhere in between, are you arguing, we need to have some mechanism that will provide a result that validates the victim, but leaves the perpetrator, alleged perpetrator, to kind of live to continue for another day?
No, it's not so much that. I think it comes back to Tarana's point that we need to focus on the impact of sexual harassment on those who have experienced it. And that needs to be a conversation we have that doesn't have to be tied up in talking about perpetrator accountability. I think perpetrator accountability is also, you know, critically important, especially when we look at, for example, the way in which women will perceive whether or not they're being taken seriously. You know, for so long, women, particularly in the workplace, have looked at their peers and their friends and their colleagues make these kind of complaints and see no action taken and see high-profile, powerful men continue to perpetrate against other women. And it's no surprise that they have no faith in those systems. But I also think, you know, to your point about whether or not there's a sort of a digital mob or whether we need to find a place in the middle, I think we have to acknowledge and accept that different people will need different things due to the sort of the impact that the violence has had on them in their own sort of scenarios and situations and circumstances. So, you know, for many women, going through a formal process in, for example, a workplace will continue to be completely untenable, just simply not possible because of the fear of repercussions, of impacts on them and their career, and impacts on them and their work security and their job security. So, you know, we need to have systems that can respond to the different places that women will be in when they experience these harms, and also the really diverse impacts and insidious impacts that these harms and these behaviours have on women, that are not one you know impact. It's a multitude of impacts that intersect with other things that are happening in a person's life, and we need to be able to respond in a flexible way to what those people are experiencing.
Well, I've been ticked off on our text line. I've said perpetrators. Someone has texted in, be careful, alleged perpetrators. But isn't there, in the course of this, perpetrator accountability is critical, because otherwise you run to the danger that we've seen, for example, in institutional abuse, where if someone isn't essentially called out and held accountable, they just continue to do it. That's the danger, isn't it, Michael Salter?
And that's really the pointy end of accountability. I think Diane's point's really well made, which is we can do a lot more to weave accountability into the work environment and weave accountability into social structures in terms of, you know, building up consensus and norms and values about what is and isn't acceptable. But ultimately, when we look at sexual harassment and sexual assault, we do have these repeat offenders. And the fact that they're never caught and punished in a certain way becomes the encouragement for them to continue perpetrating. And that's just something I think we're going to keep grappling with, because ultimately that comes down to either the criminal justice system or, civil complaint mechanisms that still sanction people quite seriously. They're likely to continue to have a high burden of evidence. And the challenge constantly in sex offences is that we often come down to a he said, she said scenario. And when those are being adjudicated, you know, all sorts of stereotypes and assumptions come in for jurors, for mediators, in terms of who they ultimately decide to believe. And that's really difficult.
So, Michael, you've written hashtag justice needs hashtag ethics. What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the challenges we have when we see online justice seeking, so large groups of people coming online onto Twitter and onto Facebook looking for justice, is that, you know, it is a really diverse movement. And I think we do need some shared agreement on what is and isn't okay online. I think in the last 12 months there have been times where, you know, complicated disagreements over sexual interaction has been made public. It's been framed in terms of sexual violence. But, you know, the facts of the case have been probably more ambiguous than that. And I think those of us who do support the Me Too movement, we also need to be prepared to reflect critically on it, where sometimes online justice seeking goes wrong. I'm not someone that, you know, I spend most of my time doing research with victims, but I think where we do reputational damage to people who have been accused of sexual assault, that's a really serious thing, and it shouldn't be swept under the carpet.
And the notion of collateral damage you don't like, that occasionally along the way to justice, a few people will be perhaps wrongly accused or publicly shamed. Diane White, is it your view that perhaps a few men might have their reputation perhaps unfairly traduced, but if the overall effect is a better world for women, that that's okay?
I think that's probably a crude or way of framing it. I think we can focus a lot more on the current harm that is not being redressed in terms of victim and survivors' experiences. So, you know, we tend to have this conversation about, let's say, the collateral damage for men's reputations, and you know, we know that that's a very small number, particularly in the sexual assault space. Very small number of false complaints are made, and yet we seem to be preoccupied with talking about that relatively very small number compared to the extraordinary large number of sexual assault and sexual harassment claimants who receive no justice and whose impacts on their lives are at best you know, invisible and at times I think you know, worsened by their experiences with seeking redress. So, you know, I think we sometimes that this conversation I think derails us. It focuses our attention on what is not the issue. The issue here is a systemic failure to properly address and support women to come forward, and therefore to leave these harms latent and to leave them you know, festering for many people for many years and having many impacts on their lives for a long time to come.
Well, there's no question that justice has not been achieved across all the workplaces of the world. There's no doubt about that, and the conversation is far more vigorous than it was a year ago. Diane White and Michael Salter from Western Sydney University. Diane White, former principal advisor to the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission's independent review into sex discrimination and harassment in the Victoria Police. Thank you both for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Hugh.